Deadly Early Show
on Talk Radio.
Talk Radio, it's the late, late, early, early show with me, Paul Ross, and a major international conference began in the UK this morning. In fact, yesterday morning. It's the International Conference on Addiction and Associated Disorders. Over 1,000 people are attending, including delegates from all over the world, and one of them joins us now. His name is Michael Gillis. He's an addictions expert with over 28 years' experience in the behavioural health industry and is now Chief Clinical Officer at The Cabin, which is in Northern Thailand, Chiang Mai. Good morning, Michael, and welcome to Talk Radio.
Good morning, and thank you for having me on the show.
Now, we talk a lot more as a society, I think, about the problems of addiction and dependency, but we're also hearing quite a lot, certainly over the past 5 years, maybe longer, over new kinds of addictions. Is it possible to give us a kind of overview about the changes we've seen, maybe over the past 10, 15 years? What new addictions are around, or is it driven by the same addictive behavior?
Well, it's a combination of both those things, but you can certainly look at technology first and foremost. One of the things that happened when the internet was first developed, people used it actually as access to pornography and sexual hookups and that sort of thing. So it's sort of been a parallel process with the development of the internet and then seeing more and more cases of sexual addiction or sexually addicted beaters as a result. Fast forward in the past 5 years, we're seeing lots of cases across countries, actually, internationally, of things like screen addiction, gaming addiction, online sports betting, and that sort of thing. So that's definitely in the forefront these days, in addition to substance abuse.
Now, some people listening might be forgiven for thinking one might be able to understand, hopefully sympathize with, the kind of the returns one gets from substance abuse, if that makes sense. You know, the kind of buzz you might get from drugs or the feeling of confidence or whatever you might get from alcohol, even though that can lead you down a destructive path personally. Are the rewards from these kind of addictions you've outlined, say the technology addictions, are they similar? Are they doing similar things to us mentally?
Most definitely. And what happens is that your brain gets rewired, the neurochemistry gets changed. With gaming, particularly, people develop these online persona. They may not represent who they are offline. People get a lot of gratification as a result of wins and that sort of thing, or positioning, or where they're placed internationally as far as ranking, as far as being a gamer. Screen addiction. I'll give an example. I was in a restaurant in Chiang Mai, Thailand, 2 weeks ago, and it was a young family, a husband and a wife. Both of them were on the phone, and then the child was about 2 years old, sitting in a high chair,
right,
had a mini baby computer. So the whole family was most definitely plugged in, but it makes you wonder sort of, people have relationships with technology, but they don't have the social skills to interact with others.
Now, human beings are masters at being in denial about our behavior and the consequences of our behavior. And also, I think some of these things, you know, I don't speak from personal experience, but I've had people in my family. An uncle of mine was a registered heroin addict for a number of years in the 60s and 70s. He then became an alcoholic. He died way too young, but it seemed to kind of creep up on him, and he would never accept it. Maybe this is too broad a question, but are there things that people listening now who are concerned about maybe their own behaviours or behaviours of people around them, loved ones, are there indicators of when somebody is moving from, I don't know, making, say, some bad choices to becoming addicted?
Sure. I mean, there are lots of signs and symptoms. What happens is with people developing issues around screen addiction or gaming addiction, they're spending more time of their wake time in those behaviors. So they're ignoring either children, they're ignoring social interaction with folks outside of their behavior. You see higher rates of depression, anxiety. In some cases, you see bipolar disorder, personal grooming and that sort of thing can be neglected. All their energy, waking energy, is going into being online or in action, as gamblers refer to.
And would I be right in thinking, or maybe assuming, that there are different ways of tackling people's addictions? There isn't a kind of one-size-fits-all answer to this. What kind of things do you practice? What kind of work goes on at the cabin in Thailand?
It's not one-size-fits-all. Historically, that was the model that was available to treat people. But as sort of addiction treatment has advanced with the best of Western approach, which is evidence-based, intertwining it with Eastern mindfulness and meditation practice, you have much more of a holistic, individualized treatment experience, and that's what we do at the cabin in Chiang Mai. For Western approaches. We use things like cognitive behavioral therapy and dialectical behavioral therapy. Then we take the best of mindfulness and meditation practice. We add yoga. We add different types of holistic therapies. So it's much more of a well-rounded treatment approach. 50% of the clinical work we do are working with families. The idea that you could treat an individual and not in context to their family. The idea is that if you treat the individual, if the family doesn't get help and support as well,
yeah,
the likelihood that individual can maintain those gains post-discharge is slim to none.
And where do your clients come from? I know it's an international operation. How far do you kind of spread your net or offer your services?
Our clients come from Australasia. So Australia, Singapore, Hong Kong, Malaysia, United States, Western Europe,
right,
the Middle East and India.
And is there a way of doing this as an outpatient, working on this kind of thing as an outpatient with the cabin?
Yeah, most definitely. We have offices in Hong Kong, Singapore and Sydney. That's where we run our IOPs, which stands for intensive outpatient programs. So sometimes people don't need the level of inpatient or residential treatment. They can basically be managed on an outpatient basis. And for the folks that are stepping down from our inpatient program and residential, they can then step down to our IOP programs in Sydney, Hong Kong, and Singapore.
And are there things that people might be able to do? We talked about kind of identifying problem behavior, but almost as a preemptive strike. Is there more we should be doing maybe with our young people, maybe even in schools, do you think, which might kind of either alert people to these kind of behaviours or actually persuade them or educate them about things that are going to maybe lead them somewhere they don't want to go? Because I don't think anybody starts out trying something, experimenting with something, you know, doing something that's socially quite binding and bonding, like, you know, playing games on the internet. They don't assume they're going to end up playing it kind of 22 hours a day. Are there things we could do to head this off at the pass?
Well, you definitely need prevention, but then you also need access to treatment, particularly starting at an outpatient level of care. Again, not everybody needs that inpatient or residential treatment experience, but if dollars are put in, probably private as well as public funding is going towards educating kids in schools, families, and that sort of thing about process addiction, which is the term that we use for non-substance abuse-related addictive behaviors. If they have that education and exposure, you create awareness. With awareness can create change.
Right.
But even with on the substance abuse side of things, there have been programs for many, many, many years about prevention, and you still see people with, you know, chemical dependency issues.
How important is this conference? It's happening in London. It started yesterday, I think. It's obviously attracting people from all over the world. What kind of things happen at this kind of get-together? I mean, it's obviously not a social thing. I'm sure there's a social side to it. But is it about sharing information? Is it about research? What happens finally, Michael?
Well, it's a combination of research and sharing information, different subject matter experts working in the addiction field, depending upon where their touch point is, and working with a client or a family that has addiction. People have advanced degrees. People come out of university-based teaching facilities and that sort of thing. They come and they present new information or their successes in working with a client or a client's family from a particular clinical perspective.
Now, I mentioned my late uncle, and it was a long while ago when it seemed that when somebody was registered as a drug addict in the UK, they got access to, I think it was methadone he was given as a heroin substitute. And eventually, you know, he seemed to stop using that. He would use other drugs from time to time recreationally, but very damaging to him, and then became an alcoholic, as I said. And at the time, we loved him and tried to support him. I didn't know anything we could do about him. He was 10, 12 years older than me. Are there people who are ever beyond help, or do you think there is some kind of help, support, therapy for everybody, if only they commit to it?
There is always help, and the earlier you can engage somebody in the treatment process, the better, and the longer you can keep them engaged, the better the clinical outcomes. As it relates to the opioid epidemic, say, for instance, in the United States and also in the UK, methadone has been something that's been used on a long-term basis, and it is evidence-based. However, in the past 10 years, other drugs have been developed to get people off of opiates and can also prevent the cravings to return to opiates. And if somebody actually uses an opiate drug, the neuroreceptors are blocked. So so people don't get that high. So there are new psychopharmacological interventions that are out there, but people can get well and do get well regardless of how low they've gone in their life.
Well, that's an encouraging. Let me ask you, if I may, a personal question, Michael.
Sure.
Given what seems at times, and I know we shouldn't judge this kind of thing by what's happening in the newspapers, but given the kind of anecdotal evidence, given the way that we're talking about it in society, you've dedicated your life to this as an expert clinician, as I said, over 28 years experience in this field. Do you ever feel, despair, if you like? Do you ever feel that, you know, this isn't a tide that can be turned back? This is just some kind of onrushing tsunami?
That's a really interesting question. I don't feel that way. I'm very, very passionate about working in the treatment industry, working with individuals and families, helping them get well. It's when you see the product of your labor that someone's doing really, really well, and in the state that they met you or entered into one of your treatment programs was thus that on paper it doesn't look like they're going to make it, and they do make it, it makes it all worthwhile. So it's just sort of, again, I'm very, very passionate about it, and I do believe that people can heal and families can heal as well.
Michael, thank you so much for your time this morning. That was Michael Gillies, who's in the UK attending the International Conference on Addiction and Associated Disorders. He's also the Chief Clinical Officer at the Cabin Facility. The Cabin's in Chiang Mai, northern Thailand. I'm sure if you want to kind of follow up anything you've heard, you can look them up online. That's the Cabin, Chiang Mai. And that was Michael Gillies, their Chief Clinical Officer, talking to me, Paul Ross, on Talk Radio, the talk of the nation.